To get back to Magic Man, as I've talked to Bryce and Don Schmidt has talked to them, we've come up with a lot of these little events that happened, these significant events that, in retrospect, have dramatic impact. And so I'm optimistic that with his skills and imagination and knowledge of the field, a lot of people who want to do a UFO movie because they think people would be interested, but don't know a damn thing.
Right.
And so that's what's different here, is that we have people who...
So you're really hopeful that this movie, if it gets made, and probably will, and you know the people involved, so it'll probably turn out pretty well, it may open some doors, get some people interested.
Yeah, because I found that people never want to be leading the pack and coming out from behind the veil of secrecy. I worked under security for 14 years. I understand that. And, you know, I get people are so ignorant about security. I've had one guy say, well, all those members of MJ-12 would have told their spouses. No, you don't tell your wife. I never told my wife anything classified.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what your wife says to anybody.
Right.
If the enemy thinks he can get information from spouses, the heck with you. You know, pillow talk, that's the way to find out what's going on. I've had people say, the SETI people really aggravate me. Silly effort to investigate. That's
You're talking SETI. About that here, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the major points that I will make, is here we got these guys saying, the government can't keep secrets, and Seth Shostak, now I've met Seth, he's heard me talk, I've heard him talk, big shot in the SETI field. I mean, this is a government that, look how they fouled up at Katrina and FEMA and stuff. It's the same government that runs the post office, for God's sakes. Now, why didn't he say something like the NRO, the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, all the intelligence agencies? How about Lockheed developing the stealth aircraft? 10 years, $10 billion in complete secrecy. I mean, I get a little irked at people who haven't done their homework. And part of my theme today, or tomorrow, actually, will be that they don't seem to realize that aside from research being conducted in academia, the publisher-perish crowd, as I call them, there's an enormous amount of very good, advanced, applied research and development that goes on outside of academia. The national laboratories, Los Alamos, Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, three nuclear weapons labs, amongst them employ 20,000 people. Thousands of professionals each have an annual budget over $1 billion. This isn't six professors and 12 grad students, for goodness sakes. There are things like the General Electric Research Labs, the Bell Labs, the Lewis Research Labs. There's Hanford Works. There's Oak Ridge National Laboratory. There's a whole big community of people who much of their work is classified, but whose goal is to accomplish a particular objective on a particular program, whether it's building a nuclear airplane, testing a nuclear rocket engine. And it's the nuclear part that... I've realized that these ancient academics and fossilized physicists have no idea that there's something beyond chemical rockets. You can't get here from there. The head of the Hayden Planetarium stupidly said, and I'd say that to his face, that, look, our fastest vehicle, a Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the next star. What a stupid thing to say. It doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's been coasting, floating, if you will, coasting. Chemical rockets are not the be-all and end-all chemical reactions. That's like saying fossil fuel is it, for goodness sakes. And I will point out that many people don't seem to be aware. World War II, a big bomb, was a 10-ton blockbuster. B-29s would carry those, mm-hmm. And they make quite a mess below, you know. But... that was World War II. Okay, come Hiroshima, suddenly the ante is up. That's the equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. That's a pretty good jump.
Yes, it is.
In a short period of time. Well, let's go beyond that. We figured out, I mean, look at the rapid pace. We didn't even discover there were neutrons until 1932. They've been here all the time, you understand, long before we knew them about them. We figured out that probably the process that produces the energy of the stars is nuclear fusion. That was in 1938, theoretical. We put it to use in 1952. We exploded our first H-bomb. Now, Hiroshima was 15,000 tons of TNT equivalent energy release. Mike, out in the Pacific, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent.
Yeah, it's just
one bomb.
Mind-boggling.
And the Russians exploded one that was 57 million tons. And the kicker about this is I worked on fusion propulsion systems. We did a study of it at Aerojet General Nucleonics back in the early 60s. And here's why. In the first place, every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion because that's what makes its star work. That's the big source of energy on the block, so to speak.
Yep.
In the second place, if you use the right stuff in the right way, and it just happens to be isotopes of hydrogen and helium, which is very convenient. These are the two most abundant substances in the universe. You may not find uranium everywhere, but you're going to find hydrogen and helium everywhere. Okay, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle. 10 million
per
times.
Per particle?
Per particle, as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. So why would anybody in his right mind, especially in the astronomical community, be stuck at the level of chemical reactions? Do they still think the sun is a mass of burning gas? Lord Kelvin thought that around the turn of the 20th century, 1902 or something like that. Not more than 30,000 years or 30 million years, doesn't matter. He thought it was a chemical process. So what I'm getting at is, of course, this stuff was all done outside of academia. And these guys can't seem to understand that there's a new ballgame out there. You know, it's not the Pony Express. It's the Internet that we're looking at now for information transfer. Friedman's Law, I named stuff after myself, you know. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. And
it's
also
Friedman's Law. Okay.
Yeah, when we recognize how young we are on a cosmic scale, I mean, go back to the year 1900. We hadn't flown an airplane. We hadn't fired a rocket. Electronics were non-existent. DNA, fission, fusion, all this stuff didn't exist as far as we were concerned. Now, there are stars in our local neighborhood that are at least a billion years older than the sun. I mean, I got kind of a shock. I suppose I shouldn't have. I was speaking to a couple of college classes in Detroit, the University of Detroit, and I went through how much things have changed within my lifetime and pointed out that when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. I looked around the class, didn't see any reaction at all. So finally I asked, I said, anybody here know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the class. That was less than 50 years earlier. So we've come a long way, and I'm sure these SETI cultists, as I call them, aren't using slide rules. They're using terabyte computers, for God's sakes. I wonder how much, if they appreciate how remarkable an inexpensive computer that's sitting on my desk, less than $1,000, what that would have been like 50 years ago. I mean, incredible. I think of some of the brilliant professors I had at Chicago, Singh Chandrasekhar, he did all kinds of calculations about radiation transfer in stars, basically with desk calculators. And if he had only had a computer, much more he might have accomplished, you know, in just this short time frame. So my message to people is, A, that there's overwhelming evidence that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. B, that the reasons that it's not being taken seriously, besides the self-interest, I mean, let's face it, if aliens are visiting, who needs a radio telescope? Learn sign language, you know, if you want to find out about life out there. They're not looking for intelligence. They're looking for radio signals. And I love the assumption, and we've been treated to discussions about this this past 9 months, the assumption is that aliens are sending signals to us using technology appropriate for our equipment and for our times. Now, why would anybody make such a stupid assumption?
Yeah, in our own lifetime, it's hard to find anybody who knows Morse code anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day, right. And the thing is that Stephen Hawking, a great physicist, says they're not coming here because if they had, they'd have sent us a signal first. What are you going to send? Hey, we're bringing 30 guys for dinner, and we don't like pork. They're Jewish out there, of course. But, I mean, it's one of those utterly asinine notions that they would use technology appropriate to us when we've had such a short period of time. And look how, I mean, are they sending AM or FM? You know, digital or analog? And what will the question be 50 years from now?
You know, yeah, that's an interesting analogy, the AM or FM. I know younger people who just don't know how to find the AM band.
What's an AM? The morning show, isn't it? AM morning?
And now FM's suffering the same thing as they go digital. So.
Yeah, and it's going to all be different in not very long.
Very shortly.
Yeah, and what people forget, there is a transition time. I got boxes of vinyl records at home.
Same here. Can't find a player.
I did find one. Still haven't used them. But, what we're both agreeing on is that technology has been changing very rapidly in a few years. But if you got tens of hundreds, thousands, millions of years, and, you know, this is as bad as the Copernican, the attitude about Copernicus. Now, you got to admire the guy's guts. He had this crazy idea, which he wouldn't let be published. The book came out in the year he died, 1543, in which he had the gall to suggest, how stupid, that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. The belief was that the Earth's the center and the Sun and the other planets revolve around the Earth. You know, very straightforward. Copernicus said, no, the Sun is the center of the universe. The book was banned for 300 years, for God's sakes, because everybody knew that was nonsense. That was stupid. Well, okay. These guys don't seem to understand that we are now no longer next to the center of the universe. The sun isn't the center of the universe either. And that we're not the big shots these guys would like to think we are. We're latecomers. It's the time factor. I mean, you know, you realize we didn't discover that there were such things as neutrons until 1932. You'd think they didn't exist before we discovered them, you know. We've been made of neutrons all this time. There are many other things we didn't know until very, very recently. And most of them, that was discovered at a university, but most of the technological stuff was done outside the university environment. So we have, there ought to be a PhD thesis here. You know, the sociological complications of aliens visiting Earth. And the Brookings Institute report, I hadn't fully appreciated this, said one of the things that would happen if there was contact with extraterrestrials, one of the groups most affected would be scientists. Because their power, their omnipotence, their being the big shots would suddenly be down the tubes.
Their answers are wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And I begin to appreciate that now. I look at the desperation with which these guys are talking about radio signals.
Well, we see this, Stanton, and not only in our field, but almost everything. The human brain likes to think it's a great pioneer, it's very egocentric, but for some reason they don't want to accept these new ideas. And I think part of it is that the establishment, they're making money, they're doing fine, they got a good reputation.
Status, yes. Well, there was a comment made by a German scientist, Max Planck. New ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. And that's what seems to happen, actually. They fight to their dying breath to defend the old way of looking at things.
We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we are at Angel Fire, a great place in northern New Mexico. If you've never been here, you need to check it out. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Stanton, I had two things to ask you, and we started, and I wanted to talk about the contemporary investigations of Stanton T. Friedman, but I want to go back now to the early years. Let's talk about that meeting with Jesse Marcel. You were at a television station, as I recall. And
well,
Were you interested in this subject? Were you there doing a UFO show, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I got interested in flying saucers in 1958, read Ed Ruppelt's book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He was head of Project Blue Book. And then the great discovery that set me off in a new direction was at the University of California, Berkeley Library. I mean, I'd read that one book, moved to California, had a good librarian, read 14 other books, some of which were utter trash, including one by Menzel, as a matter of fact. And there I am at the University of California, Berkeley. I was taking a course there, and so I could stop off at the library. And I discovered the report on unidentified flying objects. That was Ruppelt's book. That was there, too. But the one I found was Project Blue Book Special Report 14. And here was data on 3,201 sightings. It was done for the Air Force. I didn't know who did it at that time. I found out later. They had quality evaluations, classification of all these sightings, statistical cross-comparison, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. I like data. But the guy who put this together is Dr. Leon Davidson that I'd mentioned. Mm-hmm. He had included a copy of the press release that went out in October 1955. The government didn't release the report. They released the press release. The press release didn't say who did the work. They didn't say where the work was done, Battelle Memorial Institute, as I found out. They didn't give the title even. Surely some reporter, if they'd said 14, would have said, what happened to 1 through 13? We haven't heard anything about them. An honest answer, which wouldn't have been given, would have been that they were all classified. But the real kicker was a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force in this very widely distributed press release. On the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That seems very straightforward. There's really nothing to this, just not enough data. But I had the report in front of me and was looking at the tables and the charts, and where'd that 3% come from? If you tabulate those 3,201 sightings, and they had categories like balloons and astronomical, you know, conventional stuff, psychological aberrations, crackpot cases, that was 1.5%, incidentally. Here were the unknowns. Were they 3%? No, they were 21.5%. That's not a misprint, you know, that's not a rounding off error. In addition, there was another category called insufficient information. If there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, it could not be listed as an unknown, and it's only the unknowns that we're interested in. There were 9.3% unknown, insufficient information. Uh-huh. So that one shook me up. Look, I was working under security. I'd been lecturing for, at that time, I hadn't given any lectures in 1960, but when you work under security, sometimes you are rather careful in what you say to avoid releasing classified information. There are certain rules, and you try not to lie, but you don't want to give out classified data either. But flat-out lying was something new to me, especially from the Secretary of the Air Force. So I was determined to get to the bottom of this. I joined APRO and NICAP. We talked about it, brown-bagging lunches at the technical places that I work.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave my first lecture. It's hard to imagine looking back at my life, you know, what a strange way to start my public UFO career. Frank Edwards had published a book, Flying Saucers Serious Business, in the mid-60s. And I was living in Indianapolis. I spent 3 years at each of several places as they canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, see the country, work on radiation shielding for nuclear systems. You'll get a chance to change jobs every so often. Anyway, I'd gotten to know Frank in Indianapolis, and he sent me a copy of his new book. And I called him, and I said, Frank, you know everybody. He was a newsman, radio program, and he was active in NICAP and so on the board. I said, Frank, you know everybody. Here I am in Pittsburgh, work for Westinghouse. Give me some names. I'd like to speak out publicly. So he gave me a bunch of names. One of them was a producer of a talk show at KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the old-time radio stations,
right.
One of the biggest...
famous station.
Clear Channel station. Mm-hmm. And so I called them. The guy was a producer of a show called, would you believe, Contact. I love the title in retrospect. And I gave him the pitch, you know, I'm a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. Normally that would mean something, but his was kind of, don't call us, we'll call you. Less than a month later, he called me at 6:30. Could I be on the show at 7 o'clock? I live near the station. It turns out somebody had canceled at the last minute, and I've often wondered, how many people did they call who couldn't make it before they finally got down to the bottom of the list, you know, call Friedman. So I did the show, and I wasn't as good then as I am now at handling nasty, noisy negative as the show host didn't know what he was talking about, but I was too polite, frankly. But a woman at work, a technical assistant, was involved with a book review club, and the book they were reviewing was Frank's book. She asked me to give a talk to her club in her living room. That was my first lecture. I was on that show many times after that, did a whole bunch more lectures, mostly the chicken and peas circuit, as I like to call it. You know,
yeah.
Everybody needs a free program, and we'll give you dinner. sometimes you get gas, you know. And then another serendipitous event. I lived downtown Pittsburgh. Westinghouse, where I worked, was out of town. And one of 2 days, we'd take turns, people who had to leave their car in a garage, you know, and they'd drive the other, pick them up and drop them off later. Going into work with Joanne, PhD, supervisor at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. And I'm telling her, you know, I'd really like to speak at Carnegie Mellon University. She says, why don't you talk to the dean? I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. Okay. So yeah. I did, and he booked me. We set up a date, but it was a daytime talk, and I knew I'd have to take some time off work. So he finally asked, how much do you want? And I thought, well, how about $100, thinking he'd knock me down to 50. This is back in the 60s, you understand. Sold, and then because I knew his wife. He told me what he was paying the other speakers in this series, $1,500, $1,600, $1,800. Well, the talk went very well. He sent a letter to the agency. They booked me at a key talk for me, Engineering Society of Detroit. This is not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, mm-hmm. hard-nosed engineers. Turns out they were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative attack of any kind.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been, 68. Maybe.
Okay.
And so, funny thing, I asked management, I said, look, I'd like to do more lectures, but I've got a security clearance, I've got a wife, I've got a house, I've got a kid, mortgage. I don't want to lose any of these things. I need some guidance. What can I do and what can I do? I don't want somebody to come to me, well, we don't like what you've been doing, so you're fired kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
You're casting a bad light on the company or something like that. So my boss's boss's boss, somebody comes back with the guidance. Three things, Stan. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. What more could you ask for? Well, something more. I get a call from an associate at Los Alamos, also working on nuclear rockets. Hey, Stan, how about speaking to the local chapter of the American Nuclear Society? I said, I'd love to. Well, I mean on an expense account, Stan. I said, I don't make those decisions. I'm in Pittsburgh. He's in New Mexico, you know. Mm-hmm. So I talked to management, and they said yes. I mean, Westinghouse is a corporate member of the American Nuclear Society. I'm a member of the American Nuclear Society. But still, they didn't have to say yes. So I went out there with everybody knowing I was there to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people there. For them, a very big crowd. No negative reactions at all. So when it came time to get off the business of working 3 years, you know, they weren't spending money anymore and stuff that I was interested in. I finally went full-time in 1970. Never really turned back. I've done some technical work along the way. But but what I found, several things. I'm not a masochist. I found that the response was extremely good. And I come on very, very strong. I'm not an apologist, ufologist. I found that not only are people interested, but they're attentive, they're curious, but they're fearful of ridicule. As strong as I come on, I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. So, you know, you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, whatever.
I'd like to have that record. I used to do stand-up comedy. I would like
Boy. Somebody asked me the other night, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, saying, this was in Exeter, have you given any thought to doing stand-up comedy? And I don't know whether that was a compliment or not, But
well, you're an entertaining guy, so let's say it was a compliment.
I do bring to the subject several things. One of them is I worked on far-out propulsion systems, which gets to the heart of the question, can you get here from there or not? Mm-hmm. Second, I worked under security, so I know about keeping secrets and stuff. Third, as it turns out, for most of my life, I've had a very good memory, so I could give you an answer now. I don't say I'll get back to you tomorrow. This isn't a question and answer period. Fourth, people are willing to accept data, but what they really want to know is why. Why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn, stuff like that? And the usual response when I give my answers is, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So I'm playing to my strength. Now, there was a very important moment in my childhood. Fifth grade, Rose Gutkin was teaching us about science. And the sun stands still and the planets move around the sun. Well, I just read, we were buying the encyclopedia one volume at a time from the supermarket. I think it was 49 cents a volume or something. This is a very long time ago. And I said, no, Miss Gutkin, now, I didn't sass teachers. I was an A student. I said, no, the whole solar system's moving around the galaxy at 12 miles a second, which seemed horribly fast to me, No, that isn't right. She gave me a hard time. And I wasn't accustomed to somebody coming down hard. I mean, not a teacher. So the next day I brought in the volume of the encyclopedia. And she very reluctantly admitted, well, maybe that was right. But it taught me a lesson. If you're going to take on authority figures, have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, or they'll chop your head off, So I've tried to stick by that. And other people who want to speak out, I say, look, there are a couple of basic rules. Do your homework first. Never lie to an audience.
Okay.
You may get away with it for a while, but I don't think it's good policy. Stick to the fact. And don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Basic rules. So I have enjoyed being a performer, a stand-up, if you will. I've enjoyed doing radio and television. There are times when you get upset about, Ted Koppel's Nightline. It was the, 40th anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's sighting. I was in Washington for a MUFON conference, and they had Phil Klass and I on. And we're going to be talking about government cover-up. Now, the show was a little shorter than it had to be because Jackie Gleason had died that day, so they had to spend a few minutes on him. But when we went in there, I've got a bunch of blacked-out documents. We're talking about government cover-up. See, here's the proof. Oh, you can't bring anything in. Why not? Well, that's not how we do things here. And you argue a little bit, and you lose, And then the circumstances. They put me facing a camera and Phil 2 feet away from me facing a camera. Don't look at each other. Now, how can you argue with somebody and not look at them? It might as well be by radio, by phone, And so we went at it, and people next day at the MUFON conference asked me, how did it go? I said, I don't know. You're on the show. I said, look, I don't know what you saw. I don't know what the audience saw. We each have a camera. Well, how was Ted? Well, I don't know. Never saw him. Well, didn't you see him on a monitor? No. I heard him through my ear. Now, you denied all the nonverbal cues that you and I sitting here, I can see when you raise an eyebrow,
right,
and stuff
right.
like that. It's a strange way to do stuff. And then you get the dishonest people. I get a call from a guy in California, Southern California. They're doing a show on abductions and they for Dick Clark. Now, if you can't trust Dick Clark, who can you trust, you know? And they'd done most of the show, but they needed to sharpen it up a little bit. Could I come out? And they'd ask me questions. And, okay, I have a daughter in Southern California. I don't often get a chance to see her, so this would be a chance to see my daughter. Okay, and they asked me a whole bunch of questions. I gave them answers. They must have liked them because they used a lot of them on the show. What the show basically was, they had this cockamamie story that this family in Minnesota had encounters with aliens and had filmed it, and the film was found later. How exciting, you know. And they would have my comments. They'd ask about electromagnetic effects, and I would talk about them. Then they'd show something happening in the story. And I was used and abused, but good. And people came down on me. Oh, Stan, how could you get involved with that? And I said, well, you know, that's not the story I was told. Nobody asked me about that footage, but they cleverly intercut what I said with what was there. And
we'll try not to do that. We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we'll try to be honest here in our approach.
I trust you, Jerry.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back and wrap this up. I've got a big question for you, and that is basically, why did Jesse Marcel finally come clean, start talking about all this? We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin.
We didn't get to that, did
I don't know if you've noticed, probably most people have, when they come to jerrypippin.com. Sometimes you click on something and voila, you're at another website. We have two companion websites and they're designed specifically for specific use. iPodShows.net simply is all of our programming available as a podcast MP3. Don't worry, if you're one of those Windows PC people, we have links for that as well, even there on that site. Come and see us. All of our programming is on demand, and it's free, advertisers support it 24/7.